Then we discussed the food question. George said, begin with breakfast. George is so practical. Now, for breakfast, we shall want a frying pan. Harris said it was indigestible, but we merely urged him not to be an ass, and George went on. A teapot and a kettle and a methylated spirit stove. For other breakfast things, George suggested eggs and bacon, which were easy to cook, cold meat, tea, bread and butter, and jam. For lunch, he said, we could have biscuits, cold meat, bread and butter, and jam. But no cheese. Cheese makes too much of itself. It wants the whole boat to itself. It goes through the hamper and gives a cheesy flavour to everything else there. You can't tell whether you're eating apple pie or German sausage or strawberries and cream. It all seems cheese. We shan't want any tea, said George. Harris's face fell at this. But we'll have a good, round, square, slap-up meal at 7. Dinner, tea, and supper combined. Harris grew more cheerful. George suggested meat and fruit pies, cold meat, tomatoes, fruit, and green stuff. For drink, we took some wonderful sticky concoction of Harris's, which you mixed with water and called lemonade, plenty of tea, and a bottle of whiskey, in case, as George said, we got upset. We didn't take beer or wine. They're a mistake up the river. They make you feel sleepy and heavy. A glass in the evening when you're doing a mooch around the town and looking at the girls is all right enough, but you don't drink when the sun is blazing down on your head and you've got hard work to do. We made a list of things to be taken, and a pretty lengthy one it was before we parted that evening. The next day, which was Friday, we got them all together and met in the evening to pack. We got a big Gladstone for the clothes and a couple of hampers for the victuals and the cooking utensils. We moved the table up against the window, piled everything in a heap in the middle of the floor, and sat round and looked at it. I said I'd pack. I rather pride myself on my packing. Packing is one of those many things that I feel I know more about than any other person living. It surprises me myself sometimes how many of these subjects there are. I impressed the fact upon George and Harris, and told them that they'd better leave the whole matter entirely to me. They fell into the suggestion with a readiness that had something uncanny about it. George put on a pipe and spread himself over the easy chair, and Harris cocked his legs on the table and lit a cigar. This was hardly what I intended. What I had meant, of course, was that I should boss the job, and that Harris and George should potter about under my directions, really teaching them, as you might say. Their taking it in the way they did irritated me. There is nothing does irritate me more than seeing other people sitting about doing nothing when I'm working. I lived with a man once. He used to make me mad that way. He would loll on the sofa and watch me doing things by the hour together, following me around the room with his eyes wherever I went. He said it did him real good to look on at me messing about. He said it made him feel that life was not an idle dream to be gaped and yawned through, but a noble task full of duty and stern work. He said he often wondered now how he could have gone on before he met me, never having anybody to look at while they worked. Now, I'm not like that. I can't sit still and see another man slaving and working. I want to get up and superintend, and walk around with my hands in my pockets and tell him what to do. It's my energetic nature. Can't help it. However, I did not say anything, but started the packing. It seemed a longer job than I'd thought it was going to be, but I got the bag finished at last, and I sat on it and strapped it. "Ain't you going to put the boots in?" said Harris. And I looked round and found I had forgotten them. That's just like Harris. He couldn't have said a word until I'd got the bag shut and strapped, of course. And George laughed, one of those irritating, senseless, chuckle-headed, crack-jawed laughs of his. They do make me so wild. I opened the bag and packed the boots in, and then, just as I was going to close it, a horrible idea occurred to me. Had I packed my toothbrush? I don't know how it is, but I never do know whether I pack my toothbrush. My toothbrush is a thing that haunts me when I'm travelling and makes my life a misery. I dream that I haven't packed it, and wake up in a cold perspiration and get out of bed and hunt for it. And in the morning, I pack it before I've used it, and have to unpack again to get it, And it's always the last thing I turn out of the bag, and then I repack and forget it, and have to rush upstairs for it at the last moment, and carry it to the railway station wrapped up in my pocket handkerchief. Of course, I had to turn every mortal thing out now, and of course I could not find it. I rummaged the things up into much the same state they must have been before the world was created and when chaos reigned. Of course, I found George's and Harris's 18 times over, but I couldn't find my own. I put the things back one by one and held everything up and shook it. Then I found it inside a boot. I repacked once more. When I'd finished, George asked if the soap was in. I said I didn't care a hang whether the soap was in or whether it wasn't, and I slammed the bag to and strapped it and found that I'd packed my tobacco pouch in it and had to reopen it. It got shut up finally at 10:05, and then there remained the hampers to do. Harris said that we should be wanting to start in less than 12 hours' time, and thought that he and George had better do the rest, and I agreed and sat down, and they had a go. They began in a light-hearted spirit, evidently intending to show me how to do it. I made no comment. I only waited. When George is hanged, Harris will be the worst packer in this world. And I looked at the piles of plates and cups and kettles and bottles and jars and pies and stoves and cakes and tomatoes, etc., and felt that the thing would soon become exciting. It did. They started with breaking a cup. That was the first thing they did. They did that just to show you what they could do and to get you interested. Then Harris packed the strawberry jam on top of a tomato and squashed it, and they had to pick out the tomato with a teaspoon. And then it was George's turn, and he trod on the butter. I didn't say anything, but I came over and sat on the edge of the table and watched them. It irritated them more than anything I could have said. I felt that. It made them nervous and excited, and they stepped on things and put things behind them, and then couldn't find them when they wanted them. And they packed the pies at the bottom and put heavy things on top and smashed the pies in. They upset salt over everything. And as for the butter, I never saw two men do more with one and tuppence worth of butter in my whole life than they did. After George had got it off his slipper, they tried to put it in the kettle. It wouldn't go in, and what was in wouldn't come out. They did scrape it out at last and put it down on a chair, and Harris sat on it, and it stuck to him, and they went looking for it all over the room. "I'll take my oath I put it down on that chair," said George, staring at the empty seat. "I saw you do it myself not a minute ago," said Harris. Then they started round the room again looking for it, and then they met again in the centre and stared at one another. "Most extraordinary thing I ever heard of," said George. "So mysterious," said Harris. Then George got round at the back of Harris and saw it. "Why, here it is all the time!" he exclaimed indignantly. "Where?" cried Harris, spinning round. "Oh, stand still, can't you?" roared George, flying after him. And they got it off and packed it in the teapot. Montmorency was in it all, of course. Montmorency's ambition in life is to get in the way and be sworn at. If he can squirm in anywhere where he particularly is not wanted, and be a perfect nuisance, and make people mad and have things thrown at his head, then he feels his day has not been wasted. To get somebody to stumble over him and curse him steadily for an hour is his highest aim and object. And when he succeeded in accomplishing this, his conceit becomes quite unbearable. He came and sat down on things just when they were wanted to be packed, and he laboured under the fixed belief that whenever Harris or George reached out their hand for anything, it was his cold, damp nose that they wanted. He put his leg into the jam, and he worried the teaspoons, and he pretended that the lemons were rats, and got into the hamper and killed three of them before Harris could land him with the frying pan. Harris said I encouraged him. I didn't encourage him. A dog like that didn't want any encouragement. It's the natural, original sin that is born in him that makes him do things like that. The packing was done at 10:50, and Harris sat on the big hamper and said he hoped nothing would be found broken. George said if anything was broken, it was broken, which reflection seemed to comfort him. He also said he was ready for bed. We were all ready for bed. Harris was to sleep with us that night, and we went upstairs. Since George was going to work in the morning, he said, "What time shall I wake you, fellows?" Harris said, 7. I said, "No, 6. Harris and I had a bit of a row over it, but at last split the difference and said 6:30. "Wake us at 6:30, George," we said. George made no answer, and we found, on going over, that he'd been asleep for some time. So we went to bed ourselves. It was Mrs. Poppets that woke me up next morning. She said, "Do you know that it's nearly 9 o'clock, sir?" "Nine o' what?" I cried, starting up. I woke Harris and told him. He said, "I thought you wanted to get up at 6. "So I did," I answered. "Why didn't you wake me?" he retorted. "Now we shan't get on the water till after 12. I wonder you take the trouble to get up at all." I replied, "lucky for you that I do. If I hadn't woke you, you'd have lain there for the whole fortnight." We snarled at one another in this strain for the next few minutes, when we were interrupted by a defiant snore from George. It reminded us, for the first time since our being called, of his existence. There he lay, the man who'd wanted to know what time he should wake us, on his back, with his mouth wide open and his knees stuck up, throwing away in hideous sloth the inestimable gift of time. It was a terrible thought. Harris and I appeared to be struck by it at the same instant. We determined to save him, and in this noble resolve our own dispute was forgotten. We flew across and slung the clothes off him, and Harris landed in one with a slipper, and I shouted in his ear, and he awoke.
What's the matter?"
he observed, sitting up. "Get up, you fat-headed chunk," roared Harris. "It's 10:15. We finished dressing, and when it came to the extras, we remembered that we'd packed the toothbrushes and the brush and comb. That toothbrush of mine will be the death of me, I know. And we had to go downstairs and fish them out of the bag. And when we'd done that, George wanted the shaving tackle. We told him that he would have to go without shaving that morning, as we weren't going to unpack that bag again for him nor for anyone like him. He said, "Oh, don't be absurd. How can I go into the city like this?" It was certainly rather tough on the city, but what cared we for human suffering? As Harris said in his common, vulgar way, the city would have to lump it. We went downstairs to breakfast. Montmorency had invited two other dogs to come and see him off, and they were whiling away the time by fighting on the doorstep. We calmed them with an umbrella and sat down to chops and cold beef. George finished first, and getting up, said he would meet us at Shepperton at 5 o'clock that evening. Then he sneaked the cigarette that I had carefully rolled up for myself and went off to work. Then Harris and I, having finished up the few things left on the table, carted out our luggage on the doorstep and waited for a cab. There seemed a good deal of luggage when we put it all together. There was the Gladstone and the small handbag and the two hampers and a large roll of rugs and some 4 or 5 overcoats and mackintoshes and a few umbrellas. And then there was a melon by itself in a bag because it was too bulky to go in anywhere, and a couple of pounds of grapes in another bag and a Japanese paper umbrella and a frying pan which, being too long to pack, we'd wrapped round with brown paper. It did look a lot, and Harris and I began to feel rather ashamed of it. Though why we should be, I can't see. No cab came by, but the street boys did, and got interested in the show, apparently, and stopped. At last, an empty cab turned up. It is a street where, as a rule, and when they are not wanted, empty cabs pass at the rate of 3 a minute and hang about and get in your way. And packing ourselves and our belongings into it, and shooting out a couple of Montmorency's friends, who had evidently sworn never to forsake him, we drove away amidst the cheers of the crowd, one boy shying a carrot after us for luck. We got to Waterloo at 11, and asked where the 11:05 started from. Of course, nobody knew. Nobody at Waterloo ever does know where a train is going to start from, or where a train, when it does start, is going to, or anything about it. The porter who took our things thought it would go from No. 2 platform, while another porter, with whom he discussed the question, had heard a rumour that it would go from No. 1. The stationmaster, on the other hand, was convinced it would start from the local. To put an end to the matter, we went upstairs and asked the traffic superintendent, and he told us that he'd just met a man who said he'd seen it at No. 3 platform. We went to No. 3 platform, but the authorities there said they rather thought that train was the Southampton Express, or else the Windsor Loop. But they were sure it wasn't the Kingston train. Though why they were sure it wasn't, they couldn't say. Then our porter said he thought that it must be on the high-level platform, said he thought he knew the train. So we went to the high-level platform and saw the engine driver, and asked him if he was going to Kingston. He said he couldn't say for certain, of course, but that he rather thought he was. Anyhow, if he wasn't the 11.5 for Kingston, he said he was pretty confident that he was the 9.32 for Virginia Water, or the 10 a.m. express for the Isle of Wight, or somewhere in that direction, and we should all know when we got there. We slipped half a crown into his hand and begged him to be the 11.5 for Kingston. "Nobody will ever know on this line," we said, "what you are or where you're going. You know the way, you slip off quietly and go to Kingston." "Well, I dunno, gents," replied the noble fellow, "but I suppose some train's got to go to Kingston, and I'll do it. Give me the half crown." Thus we got to Kingston by the London and South Western Railway. We learnt afterwards that the train we'd come by was really the Exeter Mail, and that they'd spent hours at Waterloo looking for it, and nobody knew what had become of it. Our boat was waiting for us at Kingston, just below the bridge, and to it we wended our way, and round it we stored our luggage, and into it we stepped. "Are you all right, sir?" said the man. "Right it is," we answered, and with Harris at the sculls, and I at the tiller lines, and Montmorency, unhappy and deeply suspicious, in the prow, out we shot on the waters which, for a fortnight, were to be our home.